CHAPTER XIV of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. CHAPTER XIV. How a Strange Visitor Came to Camp. Jack seemed very little the worse after a good night's rest, that is to say, bodily. He was a little white, and his breakfast did not disappear so rapidly as usual, for, probably on account of his great length and the enormous amount of circulation and support to keep up, Jack Penny used to eat about as much as two ordinary boys. He was, however, evidently a little bit upset in his mind, and he laid this open to me just before starting once more. "I say," he said in a low tone, "did I seem such a very great coward yesterday, Joe Carstairs?" "Coward? No," I said, "not you. Anyone would have been frightened." "But I hollered so," whispered Jack. "I don't think a young fellow ought to holler like a great girl." "I know I should," I replied. "There, never mind now. They're all ready to start. Come on." Jack Penny shook his head rather thoughtfully, and then, in a dissatisfied, dreamy way, he walked on with me, shouldering his gun and stooping more than ever, so that it seemed as if he were looking for something which he could not find. We had to pass pretty close to the crocodile, so close that Jack nearly stumbled over it, and a cry of horror involuntarily escaped him as he jumped aside. Then, turning scarlet with annoyance, he gave the monster a kick and darted back, holding his nose, for it was exhaling a most offensive musky odor. I looked at the creature closely and with some curiosity, thinking the while how much smaller it was than those we had seen in the lagoon. All the same, though, it was fully as big in body as a man, though double the length. It was not going to poison the air long, for already it was covered with something red, and a long red line extended from it right away into the jungle. Every tiny red object was an ant, and from experience I knew that very soon every particle of flesh would be devoured. Keeping within easy reach of the river, we journeyed steadily on, finding the country grow more beautiful at every step. The trees were bigger, the bamboos taller and more feathery. In the sunny patches, flowers were in abundance, and we had no want of opportunities for supplying our larder. Large pheasant-like birds with long tails and crests and plumage of the most beautiful tints being plentiful. It seemed a pity to shoot them, but it was a necessity, for our supply of powder, shot, and ball was looked upon by us as so much condensed meat, ready to be expanded when opportunity served. We encountered nothing particular that day except Gyp, who turned up all at once with a piece of furry skin in his mouth, all he had been able to carry of some deer that he had run down, and at the sight of his friend, Jack Penny became more himself, throwing off a good deal of his gloom. In fact, I saw the tears stand in his eyes as he saw him once more. But catching sight of me looking at him, he scowled, and running to the dog, kicked him over and over again, quite savagely. "Just you run away again," he drawled angrily, "and I'll about kill you. That's what I'll do with you." Gyp closed his eyes and winced, and crouched down close to the ground, till his master had ceased punishing him. Then he rose dejectedly, and followed quite in the rear of our party, with drooping head and tail. I noticed at the time that Jimmy had watched all of this with sparkling eyes, wonderfully intent, but I thought no more of it until I saw the black glance at us all in turn, and then begin to slink back. "What is he after now?" I said to myself, and stepping aside among the thick leafage, I let our party go by and stopped to see what Jimmy was about to do. I had not long to wait, for the fact was that the black had snatched at the opportunity to tyrannise over something. He had been summarily checked when amusing himself by sticking his spear into the New Guinea men, and as we have seen, one of them resented it. But here was a chance. Gyp had been beaten, and had cowered down under his master's blows, so Jimmy took out his waddy, and after glancing forward to see that he was not observed, he waited until Gyp came up slowly and casting sidelong looks at the Australian, who gave him a heavy thump on the ribs with the war club. "Bad bunyip dog, good for nothing, dirty dingle dog," cried Jimmy. "Go long, bad for good dog, get, yah!" This last was a terrific yell of fear and pain, for instead of cowering down and suffering himself to be beaten and kicked, Gyp knew that this was not his master. For one moment he had stood astonished at the blow, then seemed puzzled by the strange broken English objurgations, then with a fierce snarl he darted at the black and tried to seize him by the legs, an attack which Jimmy avoided by making a tremendous spring, catching at a horizontal branch above him, and swinging himself up into a tree, where he crouched like a monkey, showering down angry epithets upon the dog as it barked and yelped at him furiously. I came out of my hiding place laughing till the tears ran down my cheeks, and the noise made by Gyp brought back the doctor and Jack Penny, the latter taking in the situation at a glance and indulging in a broad grin. "Take away, bunyip dog! Take him away, or Jimmy kill him!" cried the black. "All right," said Jack Penny, "come down and kill him then." But Jimmy showed no disposition to move, and it was not until Jack had ordered the dog away that the black dropped down, looking at me very sheepishly and acting like a shamefaced child. As we proceeded further into the interior, wild creatures grew more abundant, and we saw fewer traces of man having traversed these regions. As I noted the various objects, I could not help feeling how my father must have revelled in exploring such a naturalist paradise as this, and I grew more hopeful as the idea gained ground in my mind that very likely he was busy in the interior still pursuing his researches. We travelled very little way now without catching glimpses of some of the occupants of these wilds. Perhaps it was but a glimpse, but generally we were able to distinguish what it was that darted through bush, tree, or shadowy glade. Once or twice we caught sight of the spots of leopards, then a graceful deer would stand at gaze for a moment before going off like the wind. Once a herd of heavy buffalo started up before us and crashed through the undergrowth, and at last, as we drew near a great tree, the doctor said, pointing upward, "No fear of our wanting food, Joe, while there are such birds as these," as he spoke, with a noise like a whirlwind, a flock of great pigeons took flight, great fellows, three times as big as ordinary pigeons, and, as we know from those shot in Australia, splendid eating. The great tree offered so pleasant a camping place that we decided to pass the night there, and after a look around to see if there was likely to be danger lurking near, the fire was lit, the blacks setting to work at once to collect wood when they had put down their burdens. When food was prepared and a hearty meal enjoyed, the restful sensation that came over us after the day's exertions being most delicious. Then one by one our followers dropped to sleep, Jack Penny, who was still rather grumpy, last. The doctor and I were sitting together by the fire that night, talking in a low voice about our plans, and agreeing that we could not do better than wander on and on through the wilds until we learned some tidings of the lost man, when suddenly my companion laid his finger on his lips and bent forward as if listening. I listened too, thinking the while how strange it all looked about us, with the fire casting weird shadows all round, while the silence now was almost appalling. "Nothing, Joe," said the doctor, dropping his hand. "I thought I heard something." "I'm sure I did," I whispered, with a strange feeling upon me that it would be dangerous to speak aloud. "There are curious sounds heard sometimes in forests," he said thoughtfully. "There, go on. What were we talking about?" As he spoke, there was a strange rushing noise, then a peculiar whining sound, not far distant among the trees. "What can that be, doctor?" I whispered. "Can't say, Joe. Sounds as if some animal had been climbing along a branch, or had bent down a sapling, then let it fly up again with a loud whish among the trees." "That is just how it sounded to me," I said, gazing full in his eyes. He remained silent for a few moments, not listening, but thinking. "We must take a lesson from our friend Jack Penny there," he said, smiling in my face as he stroked his broad beard. "I must confess, Joe, to feeling a curious sensation of awe as we sit out here in this primeval forest, surrounded by teeming savage life, but Jack Penny sleeps coolly through it all, and, as I say, we must take a lesson from him and get used to these strange sounds." "There it is again," I said, catching his arm, and unable to control the feeling that at any moment something might spring out of the darkness upon my back. For the same curious rustling of leaves came whispering from among the trees, and then there was a low expiration of breath, as if some great beast had yawned. "Click-click, click-click," sounded loudly on the night air, and I followed the doctor's example, cocking both barrels of my piece. "It's coming nearer, whatever it is," said the doctor in a low tone, "and that strange noise means, I think, that it is some great serpent." "But would serpents be out at night?" I said. "That one was the other night, Joe, and we must not reckon upon the regular habits of animals if we light great fires in their lairs." We sat listening again, and the rustling sound began once more. "It's just as if the thing were climbing along trees that are not strong enough to bear it," I said in an excited whisper, "and they keep flying up after it passes." "Hush," said the doctor. We listened, and from out of the darkest part before us there arose a loud tearing sound, as if bark was being scratched from a tree trunk. "Some kind of beast of the cat family, I should say," whispered the doctor. "Psst, be ready, but don't fire unless we are attacked." Just then there was a rush, a scramble, a dull thud, and some creature uttered a sound that sounded like the word "howl" in a hollow, echoing tone. Again and again there was a low rustling, and then that word "howl" that seemed to come from some great throat, and in imagination I saw in the darkness a pair of fiery eyes and a set of great sharp teeth. "Yes, some kind of cat, leopard or panther," said the doctor, but low as his utterance was, it seemed to irritate the creature in our neighbourhood, as it kept on the rustling, for there was a harsh exclamation, and the earth seemed to be torn up. Then all at once the sound ceased, and it was perfectly still for quite a quarter of an hour, which seemed an endless time, and then, tired of staring intently into the darkness, and too much excited to be silent, I whispered, "This night watching is the hardest part of our work, doctor." "Oh, no, my boy. It makes you a little creepy at first, but as soon as you feel your own power, and how you must alarm these creatures, you'll get used to it." "But the fire makes them see us, and we can't see them," I said, in an ill-used tone. Just then there arose from what seemed to be just the other side of the fire one of the most awful cries I ever heard, and my hair felt as if a tiny cold hand were stirring it about the roots, while a curious sensation ran down my back. As the fearsome howl rang out, the doctor levelled his piece, ready to fire, and as the fire shone full upon him in his half-kneeling position, there was something terribly earnest in his face, and he looked so brave that it seemed to give me a little courage, just when I seemed to have none. "Pick up some of those thin branches and throw them on the fire," said the doctor, and I hurried to obey his command, when there was another awful howling roar, and the creature, whatever it was, charged at me, but I threw on the branches all the same, when the fire leaped up with a tremendous blaze, lighting the forest all round. "See it, doctor?" I whispered. "No," he answered, "it keeps in amongst the trees." The doctor's voice sounded so hoarse and strange that it added to my trepidation. He stopped, and I wanted him to go on talking, but he remained silent, while once more the forest resounded with the hideous cry of the beast. The wood blazed well, so that I could see, as it were, a circle of light, and behind us our black shadows were thrown upon the trees, quite startling me as I looked round. "Keep up the fire," whispered the doctor. "Whatever it is, it will not attack while there is this blaze." I obeyed him and kept on throwing twigs and boughs that had been laid in a heap ready, but with a curious sensation of dread the while, for it seemed to me that if the fire consumed all our wood, we should be left at the creature's mercy. All at once it seemed to me that the rustling and snuffling noise was coming round to our left, and as if I had drawn his attention to the fact, the doctor exclaimed, "Yes, it is coming on here. Keep round this way." We edged round the fire so as to keep it between us and the animal that seemed to be watching us, when all at once the sound came from close behind us, and, as if moved by one impulse, we bounded past the fire. The pieces I had held in my hand made a crackling blaze and shower of sparks. This seemed to excite our assailant, which uttered three hideous roars at intervals, and each seemed nearer than the last, so that we were driven to keep on edging round the fire, so as to keep it as our shield. We walked slowly round the fire three times, fully aware of the fact that the creature was regularly stalking us, for it kept up the scratching, rustling noise, and howled at intervals. This was trying enough to our nerves, but when, all at once, every sound ceased, and we stood there by the ruddy blaze, it seemed terrible to know that our enemy was close at hand, but not to know exactly where. At any moment we felt that it might spring upon us, and I turned a wistful look upon the doctor, which he responded to by saying, "Throw on more wood." I obeyed him, and the blaze flashed up higher once again, spreading a cloud of sparks on high to rise among the leaves and tinge the broad branches with a ruddy golden glow. I gazed in all directions for the danger, and started with nervous trepidation every time the doctor spoke, his words being generally, "Throw on more wood." But at last, after a terrible period of anxious silence, he whispered my name. "Yes," I said. "This can't go on much longer. I'm afraid the beast is coming nearer. Can you see anything on your side?"
Yes, I think so," I whispered back. "There's a shadowy something just at the edge of the light. I think it is some kind of wild beast."
"Is it the dog?" he whispered back.
"No," I said. "Gyp always sleeps close to his master."
"Do you think you could take steady aim at it, my lad?" he said.
"I don't know," I replied, "but I will try. Shall I fire at it?"
"Let me think," he answered. "I don't know whether it would be wise to fire, and perhaps only wound the creature."
"But perhaps I shall kill it," I said.
"It is doubtful, Joe," he replied, "and the noise of your piece would bring out our people, perhaps into danger. Let us wait."
"Here," he said, "I have it. This beast has been cautiously following us round, always keeping out of our sight. I think now that the best way will be for you to continue the retreat round the fire while I stop here on one knee. The beast will then follow you, and I shall get a good, certain shot at him." I did not like the idea at all, for it seemed like setting a trap and making me the bait. But I said nothing beyond intimating that I would do as he wished, and he went on. "I shall be certain to hit the brute, but I may not kill. So be ready to fire in turn. You will get a good chance for a sure hit. The animal will be less cautious."
"Stop a minute," I said. "I thought at first this would be very dangerous for me.
"Now I see that it'll be more dangerous for you. Let's keep together."
"Do as I bid you," he replied sternly. "Now go on around, as if trying to keep the fire between you and danger. Fire quickly if you have a good chance, and don't miss. But first of all, let's try the effect of a firebrand or two in the direction you think you saw the brute." He picked up a piece of blazing wood and gave it a whirl round his head. The result was to bring a fierce roar from the wood close behind us, and we involuntarily sprang to the other side of our fire.
"There's no knowing where to have the beast," muttered the doctor, as he realized the cunning, sneaking habits of our enemy. As he spoke, he stooped and picked up another blazing piece of wood, for he had dropped the first to bring his gun to bear. Now, holding the gun in his left hand, he gave the blazing wood a whirl round his head and threw it in the direction from which the fierce roar had come. To my horror and consternation, it was answered by a savage yell, and something charged out nearly to the fire, but dashed back directly, so quickly, indeed, that we had no time to get more than a sharp shot apiece at the fierce creature. "Load again quickly," whispered the doctor, and I obeyed him, listening the while to the rustling, crackling noise at a little distance. "Do you think we hit it?" I said softly. I was afraid to speak aloud, lest it should bring down a charge upon us. "I'm afraid not," he replied, as he reloaded, and then stood scanning the edge of the circle of light formed by the fire's glow. There was nothing visible but what seemed to be a dark opening amongst the trees, through which it appeared to me that our enemy must have passed. Then we waited, watching so excitedly for the next attack that the fire was, for the moment, forgotten. Then, seeing the glow it cast become less, we both seized upon armfuls of wood and threw them on, deadening the flame so that the space around us was comparatively dark. That was the most anxious time of all, for, do what we would, the fire sent forth huge volumes of smoke but would not blaze. At any moment it seemed that the great beast might take advantage of the gloom and spring upon us, and we shook the ends of the burning branches and half-consumed pieces of wood, but in vain. Instead of the light glow, there was comparative darkness, and in despair, as if again moved by the same impulse, we ceased troubling about the fire, and stood with hand on trigger, ready to pull at the first chance. Then all at once there was a vivid tongue of flame cutting right through the thick smoke, another and another, and I uttered a sigh of relief as the heap of smouldering boughs and leaves burst once more into a blaze. "Now while the light lasts, let's have a good shot at the brute," said the doctor, speaking as if nerved to desperation by the torture under which we both writhed. "I'm going to kneel here, Joe. You walk on, and that will make the tiger, or whatever it is, show itself in watching you." "It isn't a tiger," I whispered. "I caught sight of it, and it looked more like a man." The doctor gave me a quick look, and then said sharply, "Go on." I obeyed him, walking backwards round the fire, my piece ready so as to get a shot if I saw the creature again. But this time all remained perfectly still, and though I went right round the fire, no sound came from among the trees. "Take a piece of burning wood and throw it opposite to where you stand, Joe." I did so, and the blazing wood described an arc, fell in a tuft of dry undergrowth which burst out into a vivid column of light for a few minutes and died out. But there was no charge, no roar from our enemy, not even the rustling of the bushes as it passed through. "It's very strange, Joe," whispered the doctor. "Pile on more wood." I obeyed him, and this time it caught directly, and there was a tremendous blaze, but no attack followed, and we stood listening for some sound of the enemy in vain. "You must have shot it," I said, speaking with some confidence. "Or else you did, Joe," said the doctor. I shook my head, and we remained listening for quite a quarter of an hour, but still in vain. The silence in the forest was now awful, and though we strained our eyes till the fire across which we looked dazzled them, we could see nothing to cause alarm. "Either it's dead or it's gone off, scared by our fire," said the doctor at last. "And now that we had time to think," he continued, with a smile, "I hope we're not going to have many such night watches as this on our expedition. I say, though, my lad, how some people can sleep! I should have thought that those howls would have wakened anything. Why, hallo, Gyp, didn't you hear anything? Where's your master?" He stooped and patted the dog, which came trotting up to us, and then yawned and stretched himself out.
"Here I am," said Jack Penny, involuntarily imitating his dog.
"Here, where's that chap Jimmy? He was to watch with me, wasn't he? Is it time?"
"Time? Yes," I said impatiently. "You ought to have been here 2 hours ago. He'll have to look out, won't he, doctor, for that tiger or wild man?"
"Yeah, stuff," said Jack with a sneer. "I shan't see no... Hullo, what has Gyp found? Look, there's something there."
We all turned to see the dog, which had picked up some scent about halfway between the fire and the edge of the circle of light. He ran at once to the thick bushes, barked angrily, then followed the scent round and round the fire at a distance of about 20 yards, ending by dashing right off into the forest depths, his bark growing fainter as we listened.
"I say, ought we to follow Gyp?" said Jack Penny.
"If we wish to lose our lives," replied the doctor. "You see, Joe, it has gone right off."
"But I don't like Gyp to go off after anything and not follow him," cried Jack Penny. "He's a good dog, you know. What is it he's after?"
"Some savage beast that has been haunting us all night," cried the doctor. "I should like to follow Gyp, but it would be madness, my lads, and... Hark! What's that?"
I felt cold as a most unearthly howl came from a long distance away.
Is that him?" said Jack, whose eyes looked large and round.
"That big bunyip!" said a voice that made us start, for Jimmy had come up from the dark camp unperceived. "Eat black fellow, white man, anything!"
No one replied to Jimmy's piece of information, and we listened for some minutes, till a faint rustling, heard first by the black who stood ready to hurl his spear, made us all place a finger on the trigger. But it was only caused by the dog, who soon after came into sight, with his tail between his legs and his hair bristling with terror. He ran right to his master and stood behind him, shivering and whining, as he stared in the direction from which he had come.
"Gyp see big bunyip!" cried Jimmy. "Gyp find a bunyip!"
"I say," said Jack, "it's my watch now. I suppose you two are going to lie down."
"Frightened, Jack?" I said maliciously.
"Perhaps I am, and perhaps I ain't," said Jack stoutly. "I should say I felt frightened if I was. But if you two were going to watch, I wouldn't go away and leave you with a big beast like that about. He must be a big one, or he wouldn't have frightened Gyp, who'll tackle old man kangaroos 6 foot high. You can go if you like, though." This was a long speech for Jack Penny, who rubbed one of his ears in a ill-used way.
"Jimmy, black fellow, fraid um bunyip." "Oh, yes," said my follower. "But Jimmy no run away."
"We shall not leave you alone, Penny," said the doctor, smiling. "It would not be fair." So we stayed with him till day broke, and not having heard the slightest sound to intimate the neighbourhood of danger, and the dog lying quite still and content by his master, the doctor and I went to get a couple of hours' rest, just as the forest glades were beginning to echo with the screaming of birds of the parrot family, Jimmy bending over me and poking me with the butt end of his spear, almost directly, so it seemed to me, that I had laid down.
"Jimmy hungry," he said. "Gimme damper. Breakfast. Come long."
"Did you hear the bunyip any more, Jimmy?" I said, yawning.
"No. Bunyip go sleep all a morning, all a day. Come a night. How wow!"
He put his head to one side and gave so marvellous an imitation of the terrible cries I had heard during the night
that I felt sure he must know the creature. "What is it makes that noise, Jimmy?" I said eagerly. "Bunyip! Big ugly fellow bunyip!" he exclaimed, and I felt so cross and annoyed with his eternal bunyip that I was ready to kick him. But I refrained, and went instead to the fire, where the doctor was waiting breakfast, after sending Jimmy to wake me up. End of chapter 14. How a Strange Visitor Came to Camp. Chapter 15 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 15, How Jack Penny Was Persecuted by Pigs. I have often thought since what a wild journey ours was, and how ignorant we must have been to plunge recklessly and in such a haphazard way into a country that, though an island, is a long way on towards being large enough to be called a continent. Still, we made the venture, and somehow, as soon as a peril was past, we all looked upon it as belonging to yesterday, and troubled ourselves about it no more. I had risen on the morning after our nocturnal adventure feeling despondent and sleepy, but the bright sunshine and the tempting odor of roasting bird stuck on a stick close to the flame soon made me forget the troubles of the night, and an hour later, with everyone in the best of spirits, we made a fresh start, keeping near the river but beneath the shade of the trees, for the sun seemed to be showering down burning arrows, and wherever we had to journey across the open, the heat was intense. In the shady parts the green of the undergrowth looked delicate and pale, but in the sunshine it was of the most vivid green, and bathing in it, as it were, flies and beetles hummed and buzzed and beat their gauzy wings, so that they seemed invisible, while wherever there was a bare patch of stony or rocky earth, lizards were hurrying in and out, and now and then a drab-looking little serpent lay twisted up into a knot. The bearers stepped along lightly enough beneath their loads, and I observed that they never looked to right or left or seemed to admire anything before them, their eyes always being fixed upon the earth where they were about to plant their feet. Ti-hi in particular tried to warn me to be on the lookout, pointing over and over again to the spade-headed little serpents we saw now and then gliding in amongst the grass. "Kill 'em," said Jimmy upon one of these occasions, and he suited the word to the action by striking one of the little reptiles with his spear and breaking its back. After this he spat viciously at the little creature, picking it up by its tail and jerking it right away amongst the trees. "No kill 'em, kill all a body," said Jimmy, nodding, and he went through a sort of pantomime, showing the consequences of being bitten by a viper, beginning with drowsiness, continuing through violent sickness, which it seemed was followed by a fall upon the earth, a few kicks and struggles, and lastly by death, for the black ended his performance by stretching himself out stiffly and closing his eyes, saying, "Jimmy dead, black fella dig big hole and put him in the ground, poor old Jimmy." Then he jumped up and laughed, saying, "Kill 'em all 'em snake. No good. No." "I say, Joe Carstairs," said Jack Penny, who had watched the performance with a good deal of interest, "don't that chap ever get tired?" "Oh, yes, and goes to sleep every chance he gets," I said. "Yes, but doesn't his back ache? Mine does, horrid, every day, without banging about like that." And as if he felt his trouble then, Jack Penny turned his rueful-looking boy's face to me and began softly rubbing his long man's back just across the loins. It was very funny, too, when Jack was speaking earnestly. In an ordinary conversation he would go on drawl, 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 in a bass voice, but whenever he grew excited he began to squeak and talk in a high-pitched treble like a boy, until he noticed it himself, and then he would begin to growl again in an almost angry tone, and this was the case now. "Here, you're laughing," he said savagely. "I can't help being tall and thin, and having a gruff voice like a man, when I'm only a boy. I don't try to be big and tall. I grew so. And I don't try to talk gruff."
"Oh, yes, you do, Jack," I said.
"Well, perhaps I do, but I don't try to talk thin like I do sometimes."
"I couldn't help laughing, Jack," I said, holding out my hand. "I did not mean to ridicule you." He gave my hand quite an angry slap and turned away, but only to come back directly. "Here, I say, I beg your pardon, Joe Carstairs," he said, holding out his hand, which I shook heartily. "I wish I hadn't got such a beastly bad temper. I do try not to show it, but it makes me wild when people laugh at me."
"Well, I won't laugh at you any more, Jack," I said earnestly.
"No, don't. There's a good chap," he said, with the tears in his eyes. "It's partly why I came away from home, you know. I wanted to come and find the professor, of course, and I like coming for the change, but it's principally that."
"Principally that?" I said. "I don't understand you, Jack."
"Why, I mean about being laughed at. Everyone has always been laughing at me because I grew so thin and long and weak-looking, and I got tired of it at last and was precious glad to come out to New Guinea to stop till I had grown thicker. For I said to myself, I don't suppose the savage chaps will laugh at me, and if they do, I can drop on 'em and they won't do it again."
"It must have been unpleasant, Jack," I said.
"It's horrid, old fellow," he said confidentially, "and all the more because you're obliged to laugh at it all when you feel as if you'd like to double 'em up and jump on 'em."
"Well, there, Jack, I give you my word, I won't laugh at you again."
"Will you?" cried Jack, with his face beaming and looking quite pleasant. "Well, that is kind of you. If the doctor wouldn't laugh either, I should be as happy as the day is long."
"I'll ask him not to," I said.
"Oh, no, don't do that," he cried quickly, and then he'd leave off laughing at me just out of pity, and I'd rather he laughed at me than pitied me, you know. "Don't ask him not to."
"All right," I said, "I will not."
"I'd rather he laughed at me," said Jack again, thoughtfully, "for I like the doctor. He's such a brave chap. I say, Joe Carstairs, I wish I could grow into a big, broad-chested, brave chap with a great beard like the doctor."
"So you will some day."
"Tcha!" he said impatiently. "Look there. There's long, thin arms. There's a pair of legs. And see what a body I've got. I ain't got no looking-glass here, but last time I looked at myself, my head and face looked like a small knob on the top of a thin pump."
"You let yourself alone and don't grumble at your shape," I said sturdily, and to tell the truth, rather surprising myself, for I had no idea I was such a philosopher. "Your legs are right enough. They only want flesh and muscle, and it's the same with your arms. Wait a bit and it'll all come, just as beards do when people grow to be men."
"I shan't have any beard," said Jack dolefully. "My face is as smooth as a girl's."
"I dare say the doctor was only a little smooth, soft baby once," I said, "and now see what he is."
"Ah, ain't he a fine fellow?" said Jack.
"I'm going to try and do as he does, and I want to have plenty of pluck. But no sooner do I get into a scrape than I turn cowardly, same as I did over that little humbug of a crocodile."
"Don't talk nonsense, Jack," I said.
"'Tisn't nonsense. Why, if I'd had as much courage as a wallaby, I should have kicked that thing out of the water, and all I did was to lay hold of a bough and holler murder."
"I didn't hear you," I said.
"Well, help, then. I know I hollered something."
"And enough to make you. The doctor said he is sure he should not have borne it as bravely as you."
"No, did he? When?"
"To be sure he did, when we were sitting watching last night."
"Ah, it was only his fun. He was laughing at me again."
"He was not," I said decidedly. "He was in real earnest."
"Oh," said Jack softly, and there was once more the pleasant light in his countenance that quite brightened it up. I was going to say something else, but he made a motion with his hand as if asking me to be silent, and he walked on to the front to go behind Ti-hi, who was first man. while I went and marched beside the doctor and chatted with him about the country and our future prospects. "It seems almost too lovely," I said, "and it worries me because I feel as if I ought to be sad and unhappy, while all the time everything seems so beautiful that I can't help enjoying it." "In spite of perils and dangers, Joe, eh?" he said, smiling. And then we went on threading our way amongst the magnificent trees, and every now and then coming upon one standing all alone, its position having allowed of its growing into a perfect state. Again we came upon one of these, literally alive with parrots, and as I stopped to admire them I could see that when they opened their vivid green wings, the inner parts were of a brilliant flame color, and there was a ruddy orange patch upon the little feathers at the inset of their tails. Then we came upon monkeys again, quite a family of them, and instead of running away and leaping from branch to branch, they began to chatter and shriek and dash about in the greatest excitement, just as if they were scolding us for coming among them, chattering among themselves, directly as if meditating an attack. Before an hour had passed, after noting the beauty of the butterflies, which seemed to increase in number as we penetrated further into the interior, we came next upon an enormous tree full of gaudily tinted parakeets, which were nearly as numerous as the parrots of an hour before. "We shan't want for food, Joe," said the doctor, "so long as we have plenty of powder. Parakeets and birds are fruit birds and splendid eating. Look there." As he spoke, he raised his gun, fired, and directly the report had struck my ears, I saw Jimmy and Gyp set off at full speed. They returned both at odds, the one growling, the other calling his rival a bad bunyip dog, but both holding tightly to a large bird, Gyp having its head, Jimmy the legs. It proved to be something between a turkey and a pheasant, and from its look it promised to be good eating, for which purpose it was handed over to Ti-hi's care. The leader now bore off a little to our left, the result being that we once more struck the river, to find it a large swift stream, but not an attractive place for travellers, since from that one spot where we stood beneath the shelter of some trees, I counted at least 20 crocodiles floating slowly down, with the protuberances above their eyes just visible, and here and there at least 30 more lying about on the muddy banks. Towards evening, as we were journeying slowly on, Jimmy came running back to fetch me, and catching me by the hand he led me through some bushes to where a thickly wooded, park-like stretch of land began, and motioning me to be silent and follow him, he crept from tree to tree till, having reached what he considered to be a satisfactory position, he pointed upward, and from behind the tree where we were ensconced, I looked among the branches far overhead and for the first time saw one of those wonderfully plumaged creatures, the birds of paradise. I could have stopped there for long, gazing at the beautiful creatures with their fountain-like plumage of pale gold, but time would not permit of my lagging behind, and to Jimmy's great disgust I hurried back, and determined that no object should lead me away from the great aim of our journey. The turkey was ample as a meal for us, but we wanted food for our followers, so as to husband our flour and biscuits. Birds were all very well, but we wanted to kill something more substantial, and for a long time past we had seen no sign of deer, though traces of buffalo were pretty frequent in spots where they had made a peculiar track down to the river, evidently going regularly to quench their thirst. The sight of the buffalo tracks formed the subject of a discussion. Fresh meat was wanted for our followers, who made very light of birds, and one of these animals would have been invaluable to us just then, but the doctor decided that it would not be prudent to follow them, they being rather dangerous beasts, and therefore, though the meat would have been so useful both for present use and to dry in the sun, we gave up the idea of trying to obtain any, preferring to trust to finding deer, and continued our journey. We had gone very little further, and I was just about to propose to the doctor that we should venture as far as the river and try for some fish, when there was an alarm given by the native who was leading, and in an instant loads were thrown down, and every man sought refuge in a tree. We did not understand the natives' words, but their actions were easy enough to read, and all followed their example, the doctor and I getting up into the same tree, one which forked very low down, and we were just in safety when we heard a cry and saw that Jack Penny was in difficulties. He too had climbed part of the way into a tree when he had slipped, and in spite of all his efforts he could not at first contrive to get back, and this was just as a rushing noise was heard that I thought must be a herd of buffalo, but directly after a drove of small wild pig came furiously charging down. My attention was divided between the sight of the pigs and Jack Penny, whose long legs kept dropping down, then being spasmodically snatched up. I burst into a roar of laughter, and Jimmy, who was standing, spear in hand upon a branch, holding on by another, danced with excitement and delight. "Pull yourself right up, Jack!" I shouted, and I had hard work to make my voice heard above the grunting and squealing. "I can't!" he yelled back. "Then kick out at the little brutes!" I shouted, and just then he lowered himself to the full length of his arms, swung to and fro, and half a dozen pigs rushed at him, but he had gained impetus, and just as they made a dash at him he swung his legs up and clung with them to a branch. "Hurrah!" I shouted, and then a sharp squeal uttered by one unfortunate pig as Jimmy drove his spear through it as it passed beneath his feet, and the sharp report of the doctor's piece brought me to my senses. The scene had been so comical, especially as regarded Jack Penny, that I had forgotten I was letting several good dinners slip away, and I had just time to get a quick shot at one of the pigs, which was stamping his hoof and grunting defiantly at Jack Penny, before the whole drove, including one that received an arrow from Ti-hi's bow, swept by us as hurriedly as they came, and were gone. "Not hurt, are you, Jack?" I said, preparing to jump. "Keep your place," cried the doctor. "They may come back." "Well, I shall have a better shot at them," I said. "You foolish boy," cried the doctor. "Why, the boars would rip you to pieces." I returned to my place at this, and it was fortunate that I did so, for directly after, as if in the wildest of haste, the pig drove came dashing back, to stop as hastily as they came up, and stand snapping, tossing their heads, grunting, squealing, and at times literally barking at us. A couple of shots which laid low one of their party seemed, however, to scare them, and they dashed on once more, and hardly had they gone 20 yards before there was a loud thud, and Jack Penny fell from the branch where he had been clinging, flat upon his back. "Oh, my!" he cried as he sat up and looked about. "I couldn't hold on any longer. It's lucky they're gone." "Look out!" I cried, swinging myself down, dropping my gun, and pulling my hatchet from my belt, but Jack would have fared badly if he had depended upon me, for the little boar that had been wounded by an arrow had dropped, apparently dying, when its companion swept by the second time, but it had fierce life enough left in it to take advantage of Jack Penny's helpless condition, and leaping up, it charged at him, its tusks glistening and the foam tossed from its snapping jaws falling upon its sides. A bullet would have given the fierce beast its quietus, but the doctor would not fire for fear of hitting Jack, and he sat with his gun raised, waiting for an opportunity. Jack saw his danger and rolled himself over, trying vainly the while to drag his axe from his belt. Then, just as the furious little boar was dashing at him, I saw something black dart down from above. There was a rush, a squeal, and the boar was literally pinned to the earth, while Jimmy stood grinning and staring from the doctor to me and back, as if asking to be complimented upon his feat. For it really was a feat. He had jumped fully 10 feet to the ground, spear in hand, and literally thrown himself upon the little boar. "A magnificent jump, Jimmy!" I cried.
"Jimmy de boy to jump," he said complacently. "Pig kill Mass Jack Penny. Jimmy no spear um."
"Yes, I 'spect I should have catched it pretty warmly," said Jack, gathering himself up. "Oh, I say, I did come down such a bump, Joe Carstairs. It seemed to shake my back joints all to pieces."
"Jimmy spear um little pig, pig," said the black.
"Yes, and I'll give you my knife for it," said Jack, taking out his great clasp knife. "It's a real good one, Jimmy, and I wouldn't have parted with it for a deal."
"Jimmy got knife," said the black, with a contemptuous look. "Jimmy don't want knife."
"Well, then, what shall I give you?" said Jack.
"Tickpence," he said, grinning. "Give Jimmy tickpence."
"Why, what for?" I cried. "What are you going to do with tickpence?"
"Spend 'em," said Jimmy. "Black fella spend money, money. Give Jimmy all a tickpence."
"But there's nowhere to spend it," I said.
"Never mind, Jimmy spend tickpence all the same. Give Jimmy tickpence."
Jack had not a single coin about him, neither had I, but fortunately the doctor had one, which he handed to Jack, who gave it to the delighted black, and it was forthwith thrust into the pocket of the curtailed trousers, after which he strutted about, leaving the other blacks to perform the duty of dressing the pigs. End of chapter 15. How Jack Penny was persecuted by pigs.
Chapter 16 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 16. How Jimmy Was Taken Very Bad Indeed. This sudden supply of food necessitated our making camp where we were, and cutting the meat up into strips to dry, while, apparently on the principle of making their hay while the sun shone, the blacks lit a fire and had a tremendous feast, both Jack Penny and I laughing heartily to see the solemn face of Jimmy as he devoted himself to the task of storing up an abundance of food ready for emergencies. At our table, as the doctor called it, we contented ourselves with the turkey-like bird, which was delicious, but we tasted the wild pig, a piece of which, fairly well roasted, was brought to us in the most solicitous manner by Ti Hi, who smiled contentedly as he saw us begin to partake thereof. We set it aside, though, as soon as the black had gone, for the doctor pronounced it strong and musky, and Jack Penny behaved very rudely according to the ordinary etiquette of the dinner table, and exclaimed, "Oh, la!" It was a glorious sunset, and the place where we were encamped, as we styled it, was once more beneath a huge tree. For a time I was listening to the birds' screams and cries from the forest, and then all at once they ceased, and a long-drawn howl, which recalled the horrors of our night watch, arose from a distance. Then the sun sank, and darkness began to come on very quickly. First the sky paled, and a star or two began to twinkle. Then all above us was of a deep, intense purple, studded and encrusted with points of dazzling light, and, like the doctor, tired out with loss of rest, I began to yawn. For our evenings were not devoted to amusements. Our day only had two divisions, that for work and that for rest. As soon as the arduous toil of the day was over, and we had partaken of food, we were ready to sleep. So this time Jack Penny was set to watch with Ti Hi and Gyp, and we lay down on a bough-made bed. One moment I was lying on my back gazing up at the stars, and first thinking of my mother and how anxious she must be as to how I was getting on, then wondering where my father was likely to be, and whether we were going to work in the best way to find him. The next moment I was dreaming that Gyp had run after and caught a wild man of the woods by the tail, and had dragged him into camp, howling dismally. It did not fit into my dream that wild men of the woods were not likely to be possessed of tails for Gyp to tug, and if they were, that they would have striven to crush the dog by one blow of the hand. My dream arranged itself, and the howling was continued as I started up, all wakefulness, and saw a dark figure bending over me and looking colossal as seen against the ruddy light of the fire. "Is that you, doctor?" I said. "Yes, Joe. Wake up. I want you." "What's the matter? Has that horrible thing come again?" "No," he said. "The black is very bad." "What? Old Jimmy?" I cried. "Yes, that is he howling." I jumped up with a curious sensation of suffocation at my chest, for, startled from a deep sleep into wakefulness, it occurred to me that something dreadful was going to happen, and that we were to lose the true-hearted, merry, boyish companion of so many years. Like a flash there seemed to come back to me the memory of dozens of expeditions in which he had been my faithful comrade. And this was like a death-blow to our hopes, for, in spite of his obstinacy and arrogance, Jimmy would have laid down his life to serve me. "Let us go to him, doctor," I said. "Make haste." Our way to the black lay past the campfire where Jack Penny was sitting with Ti-hi, and the former spoke excitedly as we drew near. "I say, doctor, do make haste and give him a dose of something to do him good, or else put him out of his misery." "Jack," I said in disgust. "Well, he's awful bad, you know, and he ought to have something. Mind how you go to him. I went just now and he began hitting at my legs with his waddy, and then he poked at Jip with his spear for going up to smell him." "He won't hurt me," I said sadly, and as another doleful cry came from among the bushes, I led the way to where the poor fellow lay, horribly swollen and writhing in agony. Two of the blacks were watching him, and from what we could make out, it seemed that Jimmy had alarmed them by his restlessness, and that they had fetched him back when he ran some distance and fell, and laid him where he now was, in too much agony to stir. "What is the matter with him, doctor?" I said excitedly, as I went down on one knee, and took the poor fellow's hand, which he grasped convulsively, and laid flat directly upon his chest, at least, that is to say, nearly. "I hardly know yet, my lad," said the doctor. "Perhaps he has eaten some poisonous berry. You know how he tastes every wild fruit we pass. And will it—" I could say no more, for something seemed to choke my voice, and I looked up imploringly in the doctor's eyes. "Oh, no, Joe, my lad," he said kindly. "Not so bad as that." "Jimmy bad as that, Jimmy bad as that," moaned the poor fellow, and as just then Jack Penny threw some light twigs upon the fire, the blaze showed me the swollen and distorted countenance of my poor companion, and a strange chill of apprehension came over me. We watched by him all night, but he grew worse toward morning, and at last he lay apparently stupefied, free from pain, but as if the berry, or whatever it was that he had swallowed, had rendered him insensible. Of course, continuing our journey was out of the question, so all we could do was to make the rough brushwood pallet of the sufferer more comfortable by spreading over it a blanket, and I did little else but watch by it all the day. I felt hurt two or three times by the rough, unfeeling manner in which the doctor behaved toward the black, and I could not help thinking that if Jimmy had been a white man, the treatment would have been different. This worried me a good deal, for it seemed so different to the doctor's customary way. But I took comfort from the fact that poor Jimmy was as insensible to pain as he was to kindness, and in this state of misery I hardly left him all day. Toward evening, the doctor, who had spent the time overhauling and cleaning our guns and pistols, came to me and insisted upon my going to Jack Penny, who had just got a good meal ready. "But I am not a bit hungry, doctor," I cried. "Then go and eat against you are," he said. "Lay in a moderate store, and don't," he added meaningly, "don't eat more than is good for you." I looked at him wonderingly, and got up without a word, feeling more hurt and annoyed with him than ever, and the more so as he looked at me with a peculiar smile as he twisted a stout cane about in his hands. "How's Jimmy?" said Jack Penny. "Dying," I said sadly, as I took my seat before him. "Oh, I say, not so bad as that. Joe Carstairs, it takes a lot to kill a fellow like Jimmy. He'll come all right again. Here, set to and have a good feed. You must want it awfully." "I can't eat," I said bitterly. "I liked poor old Jimmy. A better fellow never breathed. He saved your life yesterday." "Ah, that he did," said Jack. "And it's all right. The doctor says—hello, what's that?" I started to my feet, for a horrible scream rang through the woods from the direction where poor Jimmy lay, and a pang shot through me, as I felt that it was a new throe being suffered by my poor black comrade, comrade soon to be no more. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 17. How the Doctor Gave Jimmy His Physics. I could not move for a few moments. The terrible cry and the shrieks that followed seemed to rob me of all power, but overcoming this paralyzing feeling at last, I ran toward where poor Jimmy lay, the thought flashing upon my mind that the doctor must be performing some operation to try and save the poor fellow's life. I was quite right, as I found when I reached the spot, followed by all the little camp. The doctor was performing an operation, and the Australian was upon his knees now, his feet then, capering about and appealing for mercy, for the instrument with which the doctor was performing his operation was the stout cane I had previously seen in his hand, one that he had cut in the jungle, and then sent me away so as to spare my feelings and keep me from witnessing the painful sight. To my utter astonishment, Jimmy was apparently free from all traces of his late ailment, and catching sight of me, he bounded to me, getting behind me to avoid the hail of blows that the doctor was showering upon his unprotected person. "Doctor!" I shouted. "The dose to be repeated," he said, "when necessary," and he reached round me with the cane, giving Jimmy two or three very sharp cuts. "See how this takes down the swelling, for outward application only. One dose nearly certain to cure." "What are you doing?" I cried. "Doing? Performing a wonderful cure. Hasn't Jimmy here been horribly ill and alarmed the whole camp?" Every time he could, he gave Jimmy a smart cut, and the black shrieked with pain. "How are you now, my man?" he said mockingly. "Jimmy quite well, ever so better. All rightums, tank you better," and he sheltered himself again behind my back. "Doctor," I said, surprised and angry at what seemed horrible cruelty. "Give him some more," he said, laughing. "Of course I will." And he tried to reach round me, but I caught hold of the cane, and Jimmy took advantage of the cessation of hostilities for a moment to run for some distance and then climb up a tree, in one of the higher branches of which he settled himself like a monkey, and sat rubbing himself and looking down at the danger from which he had escaped. "There, Joe," said the doctor, laughing, "it has made me hot. That's as good a cure as the Queen's physician could have made." "How could you be so brutal to the poor wretch?" I said indignantly. "Brutal? Ha, ha, ha! My indignant young hero," he cried. "Here you go to take up the cudgels in the rascal's behalf. Don't you see there was nothing the matter with the artful black ruffian?" "Nothing the matter," I said. "Why, wasn't he dangerously ill?" "Dangerously full," said the doctor, clapping me on the shoulder. "I was obliged to give him a lesson, Joe, and it will do him good for all our trip. I suspected the rascal from the very first, but I have studied medicine long enough to know how easy it is to be deceived by appearances. So I gave Master Jimmy the benefit of the doubt, and treated him as if he was really very ill, till I had made assurance doubly sure, and then I thrashed him." "What? Do you really mean, doctor?" I began. "It could not very well have happened with an Englishman, Joe. With Master Jimmy there, it was different." "But was he not very ill? You saw him run and climb that tree. You heard how he yelled. Now what do you think? Could a dying man do that?" "No," I faltered. "What does it all mean, then?" "Pig," said the doctor, smiling. "The gluttonous dog ate till he could not stir. He had as much as anybody else, and then waited his chance, and when everyone was lying down, he began upon the store of dried strips." "Jimmy terrible sorry, Mass' Joe," came from up the tree. "He behaved like a boa constrictor, and then alarmed us all horribly instead of confessing the truth. Why, my dear boy, do you suppose I should have been so cruel to a sick man?" "You black rascal," I cried, looking up at Jimmy, who howled like a dog. "Jimmy, come down now. Never do so no more. Only let me have a turn at you," I said, and he immediately began to climb higher. "Here, you come down, sir," I shouted. For answer he climbed higher and higher, till he was pretty well out of sight among the small branches in the top of the tree. "All right," I said, "I can wait," and I walked away with the doctor, horribly annoyed at the waste of time, but wonderfully relieved at matters being no worse. I never knew, but I suspect that Jimmy stopped in the top of the tree till it was dark, and then slunk down and hid himself amongst the bushes close up to the watch-fire. At all events, he was busy the next morning, working away as if nothing had been wrong overnight. He showed himself to be most active in putting things straight, making up the loads, and every now and then glancing furtively, first at one of us and then at the other. "Oh, I do like Jimmy, that I do," said Jack Penny to me, and then he threw himself down and began to laugh heartily, shutting his eyes and rolling himself gently to and fro, till he declared that he felt better, and got up. "I don't care about laughing when I'm standing up," he said seriously. "It waggles my back so." When breakfast time came, for we had a 7 or 8 mile walk first in the cool of the early morning, we made a halt, and the rations were served out by the doctor, who gave me a look and handed each black his portion in turn, but omitted Jimmy. The latter stood disconsolately looking on for some minutes in the hope that he was to be remembered after all, but when he saw everybody busy at work, eating, and himself utterly neglected, he walked slowly away some distance from where we were seated, and, laying his head against the trunk of a tree, let out a series of the most unearthly howls. "Oh, I say!" exclaimed Jack Penny. "Pleasant," said the doctor, going on with his breakfast, and seeing that he was observed and that his howls were having some effect, Jimmy displayed the utter childlike disposition of a savage by redoubling his cries. "If he don't stop directly, I shall go and talk to him with this," I said, snatching up a stick. "How? Ah! Ooh!" cried Jimmy, and I jumped to my feet when he became silent and I resumed my place. Jimmy watched us eagerly for a few minutes, when, left half-starved himself, and unable to bear the neglect when others were enjoying themselves, the howls burst out again, followed by a self-commiserating, "Poor Jimmy! Mass Joe not care, poor Jimmy, never now!" No one took any notice, and we went on eating grilled turkey and damper, and drinking coffee, and all the time I was rather enjoying my importance, and the fact of being able to control, boy as I was, a stout, powerful fellow like Jimmy, and make him as obedient as a dog. "Poor old Jimmy cut handums. Ever so sorry, poor Jimmy. Go and die himself. Ha! Ow!" "I say," said Jack Penny, "he couldn't die himself any blacker, could he, Joe Carstairs?" "Have some more coffee, Joe?" said the doctor, aloud. "Here, give me a piece more turkey." "Poor Jimmy go starve a death," was the next that met our ears, and it had such an effect upon Jack Penny that some of his coffee got into his windpipe, and he choked and coughed and laughed, till he was obliged to lie down. "If I was to cough much like that, I should break my back," he said, sitting up and wiping his eyes. "Poor old Jimmy, I do like him. He is a one." Jimmy stood watching the disappearing food. Then he sat down. Then he lay at full length, but no one took the slightest notice, for the blacks were selfishly busy, and we were keeping up the punishment for the false alarm to which our follower had subjected us. At last this attack upon Jimmy's tenderest part, his appetite, grew to be more than he could bear, and he sat up in the squatting attitude so much affected by savages. "Ah," he claimed dolefully, "poor black fellow, poor Jimmy!" And this started Jack Penny off laughing once more, which so exasperated Jimmy that he sprang up as sharply as if stung, and ran in a rage to where his black companions were eating their food. "Here, hi! You black fellow, Jimmy done with him. Jimmy gib boomerang. You no fro down wallaby." He held out his curious hardwood weapon to Ti hi, who took it, gazing at him wonderingly, while Jimmy glanced at us to see if we were about to relent and give him some breakfast. "Jimmy going," he said at last, long enough for us to hear, but we paid no heed. "Jimmy going, never come back no more," he said in a louder voice, but no one turned a head. "Jimmy go jump river. Big bunyip crocodile come eat poor Jimmy. All am very sorry. No see poor Jimmy not nev more." He glanced at us again, but we were laughing over our breakfast, though not so busy but that we were able to see the black fold his arms and stalk away, evidently under the impression that we should start up and arrest him, but no one moved. "Big water bunyip glad get black fellow," he said, as loudly as he could, and with a scornful look at us. "Here, suppose we go," said the doctor, rising. "Go?" said Jack, getting up slowly. "Where to?" "To see Jimmy feed the crocodiles. Come along, lads." Jimmy stopped short with his jaw dropped, and nearly beside himself with rage. He seemed to be completely staggered at our cool way of taking things, and at last he ran off like the wind, rushed back again with his eyes flashing, and slapping his legs as he darted upon Ti-hi, waddy in hand. "Give boomerang, Jimmy! Black teef fellow," he roared. "Take a boomerang! Jimmy boomerang! Teef fellow tole a boomerang!" Snatching it from Ti-hi's hand, he made believe to strike him with the curious weapon, and then rushed off with it into the bush. "Well, Joe," said the doctor, "do you think the crocodiles will dine on blackbird?" I shook my head. "What do you say, Jack Penny, eh?" "Jimmy won't jump in, I know," drawled Jack. "You're right," said the doctor. "He'll come back before long hungry as a hunter, and regularly tamed down, or I'm no judge of character." "Yes," I said, "and he'll bring back something he has killed so as to try and make friends. That's how he always did at home." "Well," said Jack Penny solemnly, "I hope he will. I like Jimmy. He makes me laugh, and though it hurts my back, I like laughing. It does me good. I never used to have anything to laugh at home. Father used to laugh when he kicked me, but it never seemed funny to me, and I never used to laugh at that." "Well, Jack Penny, I dare say the black will give you something to laugh at before long, for I don't suppose it will be long before he is back." End of chapter 17.
Chapter 18 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 18. How I Nearly Had an Arrow to Drink. We were soon on the way towards the interior again, and the doctor and I had set to work trying to obtain some information from Ti-hi, and also from Aru, another intelligent-looking follower who had been one of the prisoners made by the captain of the burnt schooner. It was hard work, but we were daily getting to understand more and more of the commoner words of conversation, and by degrees we managed to make out that the reason why we had not come upon any native village was that the nearest was still many days' journey distant, but that if we changed our course and went down to the seashore we should soon find signs of occupation. But I felt that this would be of no use, for if my father had been anywhere on the coast, he must have come in contact sooner or later with one or other of the trading vessels, whose captains, even if they could not bring him away on account of his being a prisoner, would certainly have reported somewhere that they had seen a white captive, and the news must have spread. "He must be right in the interior somewhere," I said, "and I'm sure we can't do better than keep on." "I think you're right, Joe," said the doctor thoughtfully. "I feel sure I am," I said. "I don't expect to find him directly, but I mean to go on trying till I do." "That's the way to find anybody," said Jack Penny. "You're sure to find 'em if you keep on like that. Come along." Jack went off, taking great strides, as if he expected to be successful at once. But he did not keep up the pace long, but hung back for me to overtake him, saying, "I say, Joe Carstairs, does your back ever ache much?" "No," I said, "very little. Only when I'm very tired." "Ah, you ain't got so much back as I have," he said, shaking his head. "When you've got as much as I have, you'll have the backache awfully like I do. I say, I wonder where old Jimmy has got to." "He's close at hand somewhere," I said. "Depend upon it, he has not gone far. If the truth were known," I continued, "he's walking along abreast of us, just hidden in the bushes." "Think so?" said Jack, dubiously. "I'm sure about it," I replied. "I ain't," said Jack. "I'm afraid he's gone right away back, and we've offended him so that we shan't see him any more. You keep your opinion, Jack, and I'll keep to mine.
"I say, I wonder what that noise is."
"Noise? Birds," said Jack.
No, that dull murmur. There, listen."
"Wind in the trees."
"No, I'm sure it is not," I exclaimed. "There, it's gone now. It's like far-off thunder."
"Water," said the doctor, who had closed up with us unperceived. "I've been listening to it, and it sounds to me like a waterfall. Depend upon it, we shall find that the river comes down over some pile of rocks, and if we were clear of the forest and could take a good look round, we should find that the country is growing mountainous on ahead." It seemed during the next day's journey that the doctor was right, for we were certainly ascending, the land growing more rugged and toilsome, but at the same time far more beautiful and full of variety. In place of always journeying on through thick forest or park-like stretches, we now found our way was among stony ridges and long, heavy slopes, with here and there a lovely valley, so full of beauty that I used to think to myself that perhaps we should find my father had built himself a hut in some such place as this, and was patiently going on with his collecting. We had seen nothing of Jimmy for 3 days, and though I suspected him of being close at hand, and coming to our camp at night stealthily in search of food, it really began to appear as if he had left us for good, when an adventure toward evening showed us who was correct in his surmise. "I don't think much of the doctor's waterfall," Jack said to me, in his dry, drawling way.
"Why, we haven't seen it," I replied.
"No, nor we ain't going to, seemingly. It's wind among the trees."
"Don't be so obstinate," I said, listening intently to hear the heavy thunderous murmur still. Now I listened for it, though I had not seemed to notice it before.
"There ain't no waterfall," he replied, "or we should have seen it before now. Perhaps the shape of the land keeps us from getting near it, or perhaps the wind drives the sound away.
Or perhaps the sound drives the wind away, or perhaps the... Look out, Joe! Look out!"
Jack Penny leapt aside nimbly, and I followed his example, hardly escaping, while the man in front of me, less quick in his motion consequent upon his having a load upon his head, was sent flying by a great slate-colored buffalo, which had suddenly charged us from behind a clump of trees where it had been lying. It all happened so quickly that I had not time to think of my gun, while the doctor was 50 yards behind us and could not have fired had he been able to see, for fear of hurting us. The great beast had stopped for a moment after sending our bearer flying, and then, seeing him down, snorted a little, lowered his head, and would doubtless have tossed and trampled him to death, had there not suddenly come a whirring, whizzing noise from some bushes in a hollow on our right, when something struck the buffalo a heavy blow upon the muzzle, making it turn up its head, utter a furious roar, and charge at the bushes. This was my opportunity, and taking a quick aim, I fired, and heard the bullet strike with a heavy thud, when the buffalo seemed to drop upon its knees on the steep slope and literally turn a somersault, crashing with a tremendous noise into some trees, and then, to my astonishment, rising again and going off at a lumbering gallop. It did not go far, for just then there was the sharp crack of the doctor's piece, and once more the buffalo fell heavily, to lie struggling, while to my astonishment I saw a familiar black figure bound out of the bushes, catch up the boomerang he had thrown, and then race after the buffalo, which he reached just as the doctor also came up and put it out of its misery with a merciful shot to the head.
"Jimmy, kill him! Jimmy, boomerang, kill him!" shouted the black, dancing upon the prostrate beast, while Jack and I were busy helping the poor bearer to his feet, and making sure that, though stunned, he was not seriously hurt.
"No," said the doctor, "no bones broken. It's wonderful what some of these savage races will bear." He ceased his examination and gave the poor fellow a friendly clap on the shoulder, while, after lying down for a time in the new camping ground, close up to the welcome supply of meat, the injured man was sufficiently recovered to sit up and eat his share of roast buffalo flesh. Some delicious steaks which we cooked proved very welcome to us by way of a change, but we did not commence without a few words with Master Jimmy, who was all smiles and friendliness now with everybody, till the doctor said, pointing to the abundant supply of meat, "No more bad illness, Jimmy. You are not to eat much." "Jimmy won't eat not bit," he cried viciously. "Go in a bush and starve a deaf." "There, sit down and eat your supper," said the doctor sternly, "and no more nonsense, please." The black looked at him in a sidelong fashion, and his fingers played with the handle of his waddy, which was behind him in his waistband, and then he quailed beneath the doctor's steady gaze and sat down humbly by the campfire to cook and eat what was really a moderate quantity for an Australian black. Next morning we were off at daybreak, our way lying up a narrow ravine for a short distance, and then between a couple of masses of rock, which seemed to have been split apart by some earthquake. And directly we were through here, the dull humming buzz which we had heard more or less for days suddenly fell upon our ears with a deep majestic boom that rose at times as the wind set our way into a deafening roar. I looked triumphantly at Jack Penny, but he only held his head higher in the air and gave a sniff, lowering his crest directly after to attend to his feet, for we were now in a complete wilderness of rocks and stones, thrown in all directions, and at times we had regularly to climb. "It is useless to bring the men this way," the doctor said, after a couple of hours' labor. But as he spoke, Ti-hi called a halt and pointed in a different direction, at right angles to that which we had so far followed, as being the one we should now take. The sun had suddenly become unbearable, for we were hemmed in by piled-up stones, and its heat was reflected from the brightly glistening masses, some of which were too hot even to be touched without pain, while the glare was almost blinding wherever the rocks were crystalline and white. "I say, is that a cloud?" said Jack Penny, drawing our attention to a fleecy mass that could be seen rising between a couple of masses of rock. "Yes," cried the doctor eagerly, as he shaded his eyes from the sun's glare, "a cloud of spray. The falls are there." "Or is it the wind you can see in the trees?" I said, with a look at Jack Penny. "Get out," retorted that gentleman. "I didn't say I was sure, and the doctor isn't sure now." "No, not sure, Penny," he said, "but I think I can take you to where water is coming down." We felt no temptation to go on then, and willingly followed our guides, who pointed out a huge mass of overhanging rock right in the side of the ravine, and here we gladly halted, in the comparatively cool shade, to sit and partake of some of the buffalo strips, my eyes wandering dreamily to right and left along the narrow valley so filled with stones. I was roused from my thoughts about the strangeness of the place we were in and the absence of trees and thick bush by the doctor proposing a bit of a look around. "We're getting up among the mountains, Joe," he said, "and this means more difficult traveling, but at the same time a healthier region and less heat." "Oh, doctor," I said, wiping my forehead. "Why, it couldn't be any hotter than it is out there," said Jack. "Come with us, then, and let's see if we can find a fresh way out. Perhaps we may hit upon a pass to the open country beyond. At all events, let's go and see the falls." We took our guns, leaving all heavy things with the blacks, who were settling themselves for a sleep. The sun's heat almost made me giddy for the first 100 yards, then either my eyes deceived me, or Jack Penny's long body wavered and shook. But we trudged laboriously on over and among the masses of rock that seemed to be nearly alive with lizards basking in the sun, their curious coats of green and gray and umber brown glistening in the bright sunshine, and looking in some cases as if they were covered with frosted metal as they lay motionless upon the pieces of weather-worn stone. Some raised their heads to look at us and remained motionless if we stopped to watch them. Others scuffled rapidly away at the faintest sound, giving us just the glimpse of a quivering tail as its owner disappeared down a crevice almost by magic.
Don't fire!" cried the doctor, as Jack suddenly levelled his piece.
"Why not?" he said, in an ill-used tone. "I dare say they're poison, and they ain't no good." The object that had been his aim was an ash-grey snake, rather short and thick of form, which lay coiled into the figure of a letter S, and held its head a few inches from the rock on which it lay. "If you wish to kill the little vipers, do it with a stick, my lad. Every charge of powder may prove very valuable and be wanted in an emergency."
"I say," said Jack Penny, dropping the butt of his piece on the rock, leaning his arms upon it, and staring at the speaker, "you don't think we're likely to have a fight soon, do you?"
"I hope not," said the doctor, "but we shall have to be always on the alert, for in a land like this we never know how soon danger may come."
"I say, Jack," I whispered, "do you want to go back?"
"No, I don't want to go back," he said with a snort. "I don't say I ain't afraid. Perhaps I am. I always thought our place lonely, but it was nothing to these parts, where there don't seem to be no living people at all."
"Well, let's get on," said the doctor, smiling, and we threaded our way as well as we could amongst the chaotic masses of stone till we were stopped short by a complete crack in the stony earth, just as if the land had been dragged asunder. As we stood on the brink of the chasm and gazed down at the bottom some 100 feet below, we could see that it was a wild stony place, more sterile than that we had traversed. In places there were traces of moisture, as if water sometimes trickled down, and where this was the case I could see that ferns were growing pretty freely, but on the whole the place was barrenness itself. It seemed to have a fascination, though, for Jack Penny, who sat down on the edge and dangled his long legs over the rock, amusing himself by throwing down pieces of stone onto larger pieces below, so as to see them shatter and fall in fragments. "Snakes," he said suddenly. "Look at 'em. See me hit that one." He pitched down a large piece of stone as he spoke, and I saw something glide into a crevice, while another reptile raised itself up against a piece of rock and fell back hissing angrily. We were so high up that I could not tell how big these creatures were, but several that we noticed must have been 6 or 7 feet long, and like many vipers of the poisonous kinds, very thick in proportion. "I dare say we should have stopped there amusing ourselves for the next hour, pitching down stones and making the vipers vicious, but our childish pursuit was ended by the doctor, who clapped Jack on the shoulder. "Come, Jack," he said, "if we leave you there, you'll fall asleep and topple to the bottom." Jack drew up his legs and climbed once more to his feet, looking very hot and languid, but he shouldered his piece and stepped out as we slowly climbed along the edge of the chasm for about a quarter of a mile, when it seemed to close up after getting narrower and narrower, so that we continued our journey on what would have been its farther side had it not closed. Higher and higher we seemed to climb, with the path getting more difficult, save when here and there we came upon a nice bare spot free from stones and covered with a short kind of herb that had the appearance of thyme. But now the heat grew less intense. Then it was comparatively cool, and a soft moist air fanned our heated cheeks. The roar of the falls grew louder, and at any moment we felt that we might come upon the site, but we had to travel on nearly a half a mile along what seemed to be a steep slope. It was no longer arid and barren here, for every shelf and crevice was in full growth of the most vivid green.
For a long time we had not seen a tree, but here tall forest trees had wedged their roots into the cracks and crevices, curved out, and then shot straight up into the air. The scene around was beautiful, and birds were once more plentiful, dashing from fruit to flower, and no doubt screaming and piping according to their wont, but all seemed to be strangely silent. Even our own voices sounded smothered, everything being overcome by the awful, deep, loud roar that came from beyond a dense clump of trees. We eagerly pressed forward now, ready, however, to find out that we had a long distance to go, and the doctor leading, we wound our way in and out, with the delicious shade overhead, and the refreshing moist air seeming to cool our fevered faces and dry lips. "Why, we're walking along by the very edge," said Jack Penny suddenly. "This is the way," and stepping aside he took about a dozen steps, and then the undergrowth closed behind him for the moment. But as we parted it to follow him, we caught sight of his tall form again, and then lost it, for he uttered a shrill, "Oh!" and disappeared. "Doctor, quick!" I cried, for I was next, and I sprang forward, to stop appalled, for Jack was before me, clinging to a thin sapling which he had caught as he fell, and this had bent like a fishing rod, letting him down some 10 feet below the edge of an awful precipice, the more terrible from the fact that the river seemed to be rushing straight out into the air from a narrow ravine high upon our right, and to plunge down into a vast rocky basin quite a couple of 100 feet below. As I caught sight of Jack Penny's face, with its imploring eyes, I was for the moment paralyzed. He had tight hold of the tree, which was only about half the thickness of his own thin wrists, and he was swaying up and down, the weight of his body still playing upon the elastic sapling. "I can't hold on long, Joe Carstairs," he said hoarsely. "I'm such a weight, but I say I ain't a bit afraid, only do be quick." The doctor had crept to my side now, and he reached out his hand to grasp Jack, but could not get hold of him by a couple of feet. "Can't you reach?" the poor fellow gasped. "No, not yet," the doctor said sharply, and his voice seemed quite changed as he took in the position, and I saw him shudder as he noted, as I had done, that if Jack fell, it would be into the foaming basin where the water thundered down. "Be quick, please," panted Jack. "I can't do nothing at all, and I don't think I could swim down there."
"Don't look down," roared the doctor, though even then his voice sounded smothered and low. Jack raised his eyes to ours directly, and I seemed to feel that but for this he would have been so unnerved that he would have loosed his hold. "Now," cried the doctor, "the tree's too weak for you to cling to it with your legs. Swing them to and fro till we catch hold of you." Jack looked at me with a face like ashes, but he obeyed, and it was horrible to see the sapling bend and play like a cart whip with the weight upon it. Each moment I expected it to snap in two or give way at the roots, but no, it held fast, and Jack swung to and fro and danced up and down over the awful gulf till he was within our reach. "Now," shouted the doctor to me, "both together." I did as he did, clutched at Jack's legs as they swung up to us, held on, then we threw ourselves back, dragging with all our might. "Let go, let go," roared the doctor to Jack. "I daren't, not yet," he cried, with his head hidden from us, that and his body being over the gulf, while we had his legs over the edge of the rock. "But the tree is drawing you away from us," shouted the doctor. "Let go, I say." All this time it was as though Jack Penny were made of India rubber, for as we pulled his legs, it was against something elastic which kept giving and drawing us back. For a few moments it seemed doubtful whether we should save him,
for our hold was hastily taken, and none of the best, and I could feel the cold perspiration gathering in my hands and on my brow. Then, just as I felt that I must give way, and the doctor's hard panting breathing sounded distant and strange through the singing in my ears, our desperate tugging prevailed over even the wild clutch of one who believed himself in deadly peril. Jack's hands relaxed, and we all fell together amongst the bushes, but safe. No one spoke, and the dull sound of panting was heard even amidst the roar of the falling waters. Then the doctor got up, looking fierce and angry, and seizing Jack by the collar, he gave him a shake. "Look here," he said, "I'll have no more of it. Next time you get into danger, you may save yourself." "Thank you, doctor," said Jack, sitting up and rocking himself softly. "I might just as well have gone as be treated like this. You might have taken hold of a fellow's clothes, both of you. You've about tore the flesh off my bones." The doctor turned away to look at the great waterfall, evidently amused by Jack's dry, drawling speech, and I sat and looked at my companion, while he looked at me, and spoke out so as to make me hear above the roar of the torrent. "I say, Joe Carstairs, I didn't seem to be very much frightened, did I?" "No," I said, "you bore it very bravely."
"Mean it?"
"Of course," I said.
"That's right, because I did feel awfully queer, you know. I don't mind that, though, so long as I didn't show it."
"How did you manage to get into such a pickle?" I said.
"Oh, I don't know," he drawled, still rubbing himself gently. "I was wandering forward to get a good look at the waterfall, and then my legs seemed to go down. I only had time to grip hold of that tree, and then I was swinging about. That's all. Let's have a look at the water, though, all the same."
We followed the doctor, going cautiously along till we found him standing, gun in hand, gazing from a bare spot right out at the huge, tumbling body of water, which made the very rocks on which we stood tremble and vibrate as it thundered down. In one spot, halfway down what looked to be a terribly gloomy chasm, a broad beam of sunlight shone right across the foam and fine spray that rose in a cloud, and from time to time this was spanned by a lovely iris, whose colors looked more beautiful than anything of the kind that I had before seen. I could have stood for hours gazing at the soft, oily-looking water as it glided over the piled-up rocks, and watched it breaking up into spray, then plunge headlong into the chaos of water below. But the doctor laid his hand upon my shoulder and pointed upwards, when, leading the way, he climbed on and on till we were beyond the rocks which formed the shelf over which the water glided, and here we found ourselves at the edge of a narrow ravine along which the stream flowed swiftly from far beyond our sight to the spot where it made its plunge. We were in comparative quiet up here, the noise of the fall being cut off by the rocks, which seemed to hush it as soon as we had passed. "Let us get back, my lads," the doctor said then. "I don't think we shall advance our business by inspecting this grand river." And so, leaving the water-worn, smooth rock of the ravine, we retraced our steps, and at last, hot and fainting almost with the heat, reached the little camp, where our black followers were eagerly looking out for our return. "Where's Jimmy?" I said, as I glanced round, but no one knew, and supposing that he had gone to hunt something that he considered good to eat, I took no further notice then, though the doctor frowned, evidently considering that he ought to have been in camp. Gyp was there, though, ready to salute his master, who lay down at once, as he informed me in confidence, to rest his back. We were only too glad to get under the shelter of the great overhanging rock which gave us comparative coolness, situated as it was beneath a hill that was almost a mountain, towering up in successive ledges to the summit. The walk, in spite of the excitement of the adventure, had given us an excellent appetite, and even Jack Penny ate away heartily, looking self-satisfied and as complacent as could be. "Why, what are you laughing at, Jack?" I said, as I happened to look up. "I was only smiling," he whispered, "about my accident." "Smiling at that?" I exclaimed. "Why, I should have thought you would have been horrified at the very thought of it." "So I should if I had been a coward over it, Joe Carstairs. But I wasn't, now, was I?" "Coward? No," I said. "Of course not. Here, fill my cup with water." We were sitting pretty close to the edge of our shelter, which really might have been termed a very shallow cave, some 20 feet above the level, and as I spoke I held out the tin pannikin towards Jack, for the heat had made me terribly thirsty. The next moment, though, something struck the tin mug and dashed it noisily out of my hand, while before I could recover from my astonishment the doctor had dragged me backwards with one hand, giving Jack Penny a backhander on the chest with the other. "Arrows," he whispered. "Danger! There are savages there below." End of chapter 18. How I Nearly Had an Arrow to Drink.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.